So we're going to go ahead and start the committee, and this is the IT Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it's Tuesday, the what?
March 31st.
March 31st. And Sean, tell us what we're doing.
You bet. Chair Riley, members of the committee, today we have with us the Oregon State Police and the Department of Justice. Both agencies plan to give us an information technology overview of their agencies. We'll go ahead and start with Oregon State Police, and if you could come on up, and sure. Please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Tom Worthy. I'm a captain with the Oregon Department of State Police, and my current assignment is over information technology implementation on our department. With me today is David Alamein. He's our chief information officer who comes to the Oregon State Police from private industry. He's been with us for about 8 months. And today we're going to give you an overview of the state of information technology at the Oregon State Police, and David will be starting.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm Riley, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today and to be able to present to you our core initiatives we have in play at Oregon State Police. I'd like to get started with the presentation, but before I do, one of the key observations that I've had with the Oregon State Police has been the pure dedication that our sworn officers, our non-sworn officers, and key personnel have had towards the mission of Oregon State Police. And that is really enhancing the livability and safety for the state of Oregon by protecting the people, the resources, and natural resources for the state. So information technology is no different that we supply the needs to, in order to support that mission and strategy, and we do that in three key areas, if you would refer to me in the presentation. First, we want to be able to modernize our environment, and that basically means to provide innovative, reliable, yet secure solutions that allows our officers to be most efficient where they need to be, and also that we can contain that within our security, both physical and data security. The next component is around standardization, making sure that we have repeatability. There's an institute known as the Carnegie Mellon Institute that has a CMMI index of the responsibilities and maturity around governance. And one of the key things that we have in play for our biennium is to really have repeatability around those processes to create the maturity where we would like to be at. Another core piece of our strategy is to be able to engage and enable those officers, specifically when it comes to empirical analysis, and make sure we use the most efficiency for those officers out there and being able to provide them with rich data analytics in order to support their environment. We have quite a few items on this slide. I'll condense it a little bit further, bring to light the aspect of modernization. As you know, through the aspects of time, legacy systems have evolved into single servers, thick clients, thin clients. We see a lot in the industry today with regards to computer off-the-shelf systems. And we want to make sure that we bring OSP up to the current industry standards to be able to look at those particular solutions that are available. And then also go further into looking at other solutions through ETS as a partner, such as solutions that we'd find as software as a service, platform as a service, also known as the cloud that we know today. The other area that we're really focusing on is enhancing our security against cyber attacks with OSP. One of the things that we have an initiative on is when you look at the industry where you find that hackers were really penetrating the breaching of a wall, also known as a firewall, that is actually old information. That's basically 10 to 15 years back. Today we're looking at more sophisticated breaches. We're looking at phishing that occurs. We're looking at those email breaches, polymorphic malware, etc. So we try and secure our environments in the following fashion. Number one, making sure that our infrastructure is secure. Two, that we have a lot of education around our employees with regards to security awareness training. And we also have hired an information security officer in the last few years that's been very beneficial with regards to group policies and making sure that we are CGIS compliant. And then we also have an auditor out there that makes sure that our policies, procedures, and other state partner agencies are compliant in that area. And then the last thing I want to detail on this particular slide is under Engage and Enable, where we connect our systems internally and externally. As you know, different vendors' products get confused over time. They have a lot of disparity, and a lot of times you create interfaces to talk between those particular devices. With OSP, we're really trying to look at our future deliverables. We're looking at service-oriented architecture that we already have in play through the means of an ESB that makes it so much more simpler for those partner agencies of ours also to be able to connect and get rid of those siloed approaches. When a vendor is decommissioned, we decommission a vendor's product, we can easily bring forth that new product and have it integrate into that interface. So it's proved to be extremely valuable in that regard. The next item that I wish to portray to you today is our OSP organizational structure. And really what I would like for you to get out of this presentation with regards to this structure is really we have four bureaus, and Oregon State Police Information Technology falls within the Public Safety Services Bureau. And when you look at the differentiation, when you collapse those particular bureaus into different divisions, you will clearly see that those divisions are almost like what I would refer to in the private world as small businesses, because they all have their unique needs to the context of they have their niche application products. And Oregon State Police really supports all the complexity around all those various applications for us to be successful in what we do. So that's just a quick high level of our organizational structure. Some of our customers that we serve are really related to three categories. And we see the service pertain to...
Yes, Senator, what is it?
Thank you. On the last slide, you have risk management on there as one of your, on your column next to the second from the right. Does OSP do their own risk management, or is that just IT risk management, or do you not interface with DAS?
So we definitely have our own particular entity and organizational structure, but we do work with DAS a lot as a partner, so that is different. We actually have a strategic technology officer that has been dedicated for public services, so we definitely work with him in comparison, but we're definitely a separate organization entity from the DAS environment.
Want
to
follow up?
No,
that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, great. So some of the customers that we serve really relate to the dedication that we have to our personnel with regards to making sure that they're operational. And an example of this would be our CGIS organization, where we support their databases, the message switch. We're also the state point of presence for any connectivity to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, including our international criminal justice telecommunications systems. We also work with our other state agencies as a partner. Specific examples would relate to the Judicial Department, and that would relate to the e-citation system that we set up and making sure that we have telecommunication infrastructure in place to go from paper to paperless and make sure that that e-citation can occur all the way to the court system. The other partnership and agency we have is around ODOT, making sure that we have operability services with ODOT and making sure that we have our disparate CAD, computer-aided dispatch systems, very dissimilar in nature, but we have the ability to use service-oriented architecture to align and exchange information. And it's proven to be extremely helpful between ODOT, OSP, and other 9/11 points of answer systems and centers.
Senator Winsett.
Yes. So how is the OWEN working?
So it's working Senator Whitsett, members of the committee, it's working extremely well, and we're definitely a partner with ODOT in that regard, and we've provided some stakeholder expertise in that regard, but that project is really being managed by ODOT, but we really feel a strong partnership with them.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So how's it working in rural Oregon, like, say, in Lake and Malheur counties?
That is a question that I cannot answer for you today, but I'm sure that I can get that information for you in a very timely fashion.
I'd appreciate that. There's rural countries out there, the backup, it takes a long, long time, even when you can communicate. So.
Absolutely, and we appreciate it. It's a very pertinent question, and we'll follow up with that, and we'll get you that information as soon as possible. And then last but not least, we also serve our customers, basically providing the telecommunication infrastructure for our Amble Alert system. So if your phone goes off with a vibration, that's really part of the technology that we implement and make sure we take care of our citizens in Oregon. The next slide that I have for you, and I'll condense this just for the interest of time, is the major systems that we really support. And the one I wish to highlight today is related to our law enforcement data system. And that really consists of a secure database that hosts files, also known as hot files, for search warrants and arrests. And in addition to that, we also have a message switch, which allows all those transactions to occur between our partner agencies, such as the DMV, the FBI, and also at an international level with Interpol. Some fun facts for you is that we have this implemented since 1997. We have approximately 330 million transactions going through the switch. We also have a required uptime of 99.95%, which we've been able to deliver consistently in the last 5 years. The next system that we have is our NISH RMS system. It's really a law enforcement data system for records management system. And that is what the sworn officers use in order to receive rich data elements in order to provide them with solving crimes and providing that investigated purposes. That's been in play as recently as 2013, and some interesting facts, we have about 1 million above database records, with an uptime of 99.95%. The other system we wish to highlight is our firearm instant check system. This is really the system that's used to do all those background checks for potential firearm purchases from firearm dealers, basically federally licensed dealers, and that's been in place since 1996. We have approximately 230,000 transactions going through that annually, and we also, fun facts for you, is the busiest day for those firearms is on Black Friday, and then we also have Valentine's Day is a very busy day for those firearm purchases.
Before you go on, We're looking at expanding background checks, as you probably know, and I was just curious about how you feel this will impact that system. Do you think it'll overload, or do you think you'll be able to handle the increase?
I definitely feel confident based on these two components that I see here. I see the actual architecture itself, but then I also see the maintenance portion of it. The database is only going to be as good as what you feed it and maintain it. And we've done an excellent job at Oregon State Police to be able to maintain those databases and make sure we monitor those databases. So as this frequency increases, we are very confident that we can handle that amount of workload.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Yes, and question on that same slide. On the other, all the other five things there, you have a 99.95% uptime. On the FICS, you have 363 days a year. Why is that not at 99.5%, and why are we having so much trouble on weekends getting into interfacing?
I think that's a very pertinent question. The best answer that I can give you, Senator Whitfield, members of the committee, is related to the actual system. When we look at the databases, that's definitely consistent. We actually had a very large firearm show this last weekend, and we haven't really had a lot of downtime. In fact, the report we received from our business customers has actually been very positive. With that regard. But we try the best that we can in the state of Oregon, specifically Oregon State Police, to make sure that we are as quick as on our SLAs as possible with that regard. We like to see ourselves from an IT perspective at that high percentage rate of meeting those SLAs. However, if there are concerns with that particular system, we'll be glad to be able to evaluate that and make sure that we respond effectively to that request.
There are concerns about that system, and it just really stands out that all the rest of them are up virtually all the time, and that one's not. And so, yeah, I would like to have a little further discussion about what we need to do to create a full-time a system there, because as the chair mentioned, bills coming through this legislature that may pass this year are going to stress that system a great deal more.
Thank you. The next system that we wish to really talk about for the interest of time is our CAD systems. That's really our computer-aided dispatch centers. It's really software that allows us to manage those consoles. And then we also have a LIMS system, which is our laboratory information management system. And that is really used for AC data management, data mining, data analysis, evidence tracking, and laboratory management within the forensics area. And that also has quite a bit of traffic going as far as the evidence submissions. We're looking at around 1.2 million plus submissions in that regard. And then last but not least, we also support the sex offender registry system. We also provide a portal for that sex offender registry system. Even though it mentions 27,000 database records in that system, we have many transactions that actually go through that system itself.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Thatcher.
I'm going back to that previous slide, sorry. I noticed that all the other ones, all the little cells.
Sure.
Said something like 99.95% uptime, but it didn't have a number for the fix system. So what is the uptime percentage on that?
As far as we know, we were today, actually the uptime from an IT perspective is pretty solid. That was a fun fact, the 363 days, but we are looking at a high 90 percentile as well, a 99% uptime for the fixed system as well. And very regularly do we have success with that. Very irregularly do we have the system actually going down and not being responsive. So we feel confident that we support that particular mechanism for the business very efficiently so.
And Co-chairs Nathanson and Riley and Senator Thatcher, just to be clear, that 363-day-a-year uptime is because the unit's closed 2 days a year. They're not open for business twice a year. I think it's Christmas and New Year's. The fixed unit technologically does achieve the high level of uptime. And if, in fact, the unit can't be reached, that's much more likely to be a network problem than an actual database problem. And the database is supported by OSP IT.
Yes, I didn't understand that answer. I'm sometimes mentally slow this time of day, but could you say that in English?
Sure. The Co-Chair Nathanson and Riley, Senator Whitsitt, that unit's not open for business 2 days a year, so their uptime is less than 2 days. And then if the database is functioning but you can't reach it, there's a network problem somewhere between the point of call and the point where we're going to service that call. It appears that the unit's not working when, in fact, the database is perfectly serviceable. You just can't get to it via the network.
Then why is the why do you have a network problem with the fixed system and apparently not with the other five?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, Senator Whitsitt, I wouldn't characterize it that way. Network outages are somewhat commonplace. Somebody can hit a line with a backhoe or hit a post with a car, and you will have a network outage. So while all of our systems, do enjoy that uptime, the system can still be up while you still just can't reach it. So there's a distinction there to be made.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the topic of outages due to interrupted network access, one of the topics I'm trying to raise awareness of is the lack of broadband generally available, that it's important for public safety, for health, for education, also for economic development for communities. But one of the issues related to that is the even where we have adequate speed, maybe for today, not for tomorrow, but it may be barely adequate for now, we don't have redundancy. So it is, sometimes there's a network interruption because a line is broken at your site. There's work being done in your own building, some sort of construction or remodeling activity. But very often, this is off-site, maybe even miles mm-hmm. away. When you have had outages because, let's say, a fiber optic line is broken, the backhoe type incident, is it often somewhere nearby, or I suppose it's because we don't have redundant systems to take us to some other to route us through some other way?
Yeah, Co-Chair Nathanson, I'll take this, and Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. That's one way that you can experience a network interruption, and you're right, it could be miles away. It's a relatively complex system of, you know, fiber and cables that delivers information from point to point, and today's expectation is that that's going to be very robust and that you're going to have service virtually all the time. It may not even be something like a break in fiber. It could be something like there was a change in a firewall rule or a router failed along the line. That's another example of a network outage. And in these type of systems, those simply, you're right, they can happen. And, you know, by planning through any changes to the network and rehearsing them and informing the customers and being upfront about what's changing, you have the opportunity to minimize those interruptions in service. And then some stuff is simply not foreseen. There will be physical failures on devices that we can't plan for, and then we have to react and get those back up. But you know, to come back to the fixed system itself, it is highly reliable. It's there. It's can you get to it oftentimes? So it's no different from our CAD system. Like very frequently, the troopers in the field will say, "CAD's down." No, CAD's not down. You're just not reaching it right now. So that's the distinction. Mm-hmm.
Can I follow up?
Sure, of course.
So I'm wondering, not only for your agency, but generally for all agencies, what it is that we can do to decrease the risk of interrupted service. What's it going to take? For example, sometimes you might make a change in something that someone depends on access to you. You may cause an interruption for someone else. You're painfully aware of when someone else does something that causes interrupted service to you. But it's a two-way street. How, other than hoping for the best and hoping that vendors, maybe, who, if we've bought software service instead of designing something ourselves, how is it that we can improve this and reduce the number of adverse incidents?
Yeah, so Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, David's going to discuss here in a little bit our approach towards change management, okay. And much of it does come down to communication, and system redundancy is also, okay. You know, another component, but I think we're going to cover that.
I'll be patient and keep listening.
Sure. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and members of the committee, just to add to what Captain Worthy just said, the two key components that relate to minimal downtime is really around your IT governance. And when I look at IT governance, I look at specific areas. This is based on best practices from a non-profit organization. And when we look at the definition of governance, we look at it based on the stakeholder needs, conditions, and options are reflected into those enterprise objectives. So you're setting the vision, so to speak. The next direction is through prioritization and decision-making and performance monitoring against agreed-upon direction and objectives. So what this says is we need to build our infrastructure from a hardware perspective, software perspective, and then also we see our actual people and resources as infrastructure as well.
Who is the governance committee? Who's does your governance in it?
Sure. So basically there's two facets of governance. The one is the state CIO office that's working on an enterprise level governance. But we also establish our own governance within OSP, which can consist of different committee CAB members, so to speak. And the initial is regards to prevent problems from occurring. And so you would typically have a board, and we would discuss issues before an actual implementation takes place in the production environment, that we know if it's been tested. We'll know if it's there's a backup plan or redundancy in play before that actual production occurs. So that really relates to internally with our teams and making sure that we follow a good process around that.
That's telling me what you do, but governance implies that there's somebody watching. Somebody is doing those actions. And I still don't know who that is.
Sure. So part of my responsibilities, Chair Riley and members of the committee, is regards to making sure that there is governance. So it's my responsibility as a chief information officer to have that overall oversight over those key members that are providing that governance, that are executing the governance, so to speak. So it's really my responsibility to make sure that that governance occurs.
Okay, I'll let that go for now.
Okay. So maybe I can clarify just a little bit in more detail. Our IT governance, we had a very vertical organizational structure before I came on board. It was very non-functional driven, a lot of diffusion of responsibilities, not necessarily providing the best capability and value for us. So what you would typically find is you would have a dissection between the bottom level and the upper layer because there was really the communication that I would receive, it might be different through the chain. So what we've done is we've basically distributed our systems more effectively and our organizational structure by implementing IT support services, security, infrastructure, and then project management, and most importantly, an application services team, getting away from the application development realm, specifically when you have off-the-shelf systems, your business processes change, you need to allow that flexibility for those workflow designs to be captured as you change those processes. So we've gone from a pure application development to more of an application services realm, which has proved to be very beneficial for us at OSP IT. And then last but not least, we have specific IT governance goals for this particular biennium. And one of those particular goals is establishing an architecture review board. And that is really, Co-Chair Riley when and members of the committee, when you were describing the governance piece, yes, it is established by a board. The CIO has the overall oversight. But what's really beneficial about having such a board is to make sure that any new or existing systems are in compliance and compatible with the current IT standard and architecture. It also allows the business to reduce risk significantly by doing that due diligence, making sure that we minimize the impact. And last but not least, it offers a very rich enterprise architecture governance and IT governance to standardize that environment. So that is basically how we contain that governance. And then we also work very closely with our state CIO office to make sure that we follow certain governance protocols, the stage gate process on particular project deliverables. We also want to make sure we're a partner with the state CIO on their PPM solution, and that's been proven to be very worthy to be invested as gathering those requirements. And then just another key area I wish to highlight, if you look at the very bottom of that slide, we also look at ITIL, the Information Technology Infrastructure Library, and Co-Chair Nathanson and Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, when that question was posed earlier, that is the key ingredient. Those are the processes that allow you to make sure that you have service continuity and delivery to the organization when that production occurs. And we're taking that initiative by implementing the incident management module and also establishing a change advisory board to be able to allow the governance around the changes that occur before it even hits a production environment.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. That appears to be 12 steps to get from point A to point B. Could you give some idea of the amount of time that you envision those going through all those 12 steps would take?
Yes. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and Senator Whitson and members of the committee, that is not a quick turnaround time indeed. And when you're looking at maturity in an organization and you're looking at five levels of maturity, as forementioned, the Capability Maturity Index, it takes significant work. Based on the 12 initiatives that we have at play, we feel pretty comfortable that that can be accomplished within a biennium. My private experience, previous experience in the private factor, we were able to go from a CMMI level of a 1 to a CMMI level of a 2.5 or a 3 in approximately a 2-year time frame. So it's definitely feasible. It takes a lot of effort and dedication, but it definitely offers its benefits, and there's a clear transition to see the IT service management maturity increasing.
Thank you.
And then last but not least, Captain Worthy will be providing us with a quick update on our current 2013 and 15 projects, including what we have to look forward to in the next biennium.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and members of the committee. I'm going to quickly blast through a few projects that are in flight or planned for the biennium. The first of which that I want to mention is our mobile data terminal modernization project for the officers in the car. In today's highly mobile society, there's an expectation that those officers are going to have a great deal of information at their fingertips. About 5 years ago, OSP began to deploy Panasonic CF-19s to the patrol fleet so that officers could enjoy the benefits of mobile CAD, mobile report writing, internet browsing, and other mobile email in the field. The mobile office concept, those devices are now end of life, and OSP is moving towards a new solution. The industry has changed away from laptops and towards tablet computing. You'll notice that if you see, young folks running around, they're generally not carrying a laptop, but they have a tablet with them. So our next generation of that will be tablet computing, and what's pictured in this photograph is a Fujitsu Q704 Windows 7 semi-ruggedized tablet, which we're deploying to the East region at this time, and that will roll out across the fleet throughout this next biennium. So we're going to get about 240 units deployed to East region by June, and then after that we'll readdress and begin to roll out for Southwest and Northwest regions to keep the officers with the best equipment available at their fingertips. In the 13-15 biennium, we recognized the need that much of our data was siloed. It was in the appropriate location, but it was difficult to follow that throughout the life cycle of a record. For instance, if a record began in computer-aided dispatch, moved on through as turned into a case, and the officer wrote a report in records management system, it was difficult to look at, calls for service versus the ultimate outcome of whatever report was written or enforcement action taken. So we put together a data warehouse project so we could monitor those and ability to query multiple data systems across the entity of OSP. And this can be done in near real time by the end user. So we don't have to go to IT and say, hey, how many CAD calls for, road-struck deer did we have in a certain time frame? The user themselves can go and uses an Excel query interface, and they can service their own data requests. So the data warehouse has made our production of data much more timely and quicker. It also helps our partners when we can answer questions that they have of, how many this or that did you do in my area? We can now answer those. And it allows for statistical reporting so we can come to bodies such as this and say definitively that we did this many of this or this many of that, or we stopped a certain percentage of this type of person or that type of person. So those added value components really are derived from the data warehouse project. And they also let us be smarter as an agency, so we can make decisions on staffing and deployments based on empirical data rather than just what we think might be the case.
So before you go on to the other project, if you would tell us where you are in each of those projects as you go through them.
Sure.
Starting with the one before the data warehouse.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, Senator Riley, the mobile data terminal modernization project, we're approximately a third of the way complete with that. And the data warehouse project has been delivered. It's under continual development. They want to add additional data sources to it. So that's going to be a living project, but right now it's functional. And many of the statistics that were presented earlier today at Full Ways and Means were derived directly from the data warehouse project. So that one's complete. There's no outstanding contracts on it. And then for our 15-17 IT projects and priorities, this is where we want to head now. We have a CrimeView replacement project coming up, which I'm going to talk about in a lot greater depth in the next few slides. It's a relatively large project, and it's important to the entire community of public safety across Oregon, so I'm going to talk about that more. OSP is also involved in the School Safety Task Force and providing technology guidance for school safety issues in Oregon. We have a crime reporting refresh project going on as well. Oregon's the point of contact to deliver state of Oregon crime data to the FBI, and there's work to be done there as well. Two-factor authentication is a federal CJIS security requirement for any device that accesses like criminal histories or wanted status, that type of thing, basically when you're running queries and checks in the field. And two-factor authentication will be like a username and password and then a device, something that you have. So we need to get up to speed on that, and we're working on it. Also, anytime that CJIS data, Criminal Justice Information Systems data, is moved by email, it needs to be encrypted, and we're working on an email encryption project. And that one is, those projects are just taking flight now, as well as a new secure VPN solution for our agency. And then the Oregon State Police Headquarters, Northwest Region, and Salem Patrol Office are scheduled to move to a new facility down off of Kubler Boulevard. It's called the Trailstead Project, and OSP IT is going to be a key support in that as well to make sure that that building is future-proofed because, like you said, Representative Nathanson, our data needs now are not what they're going to be tomorrow. So we're going to make sure that that building is future-proofed, so to speak. I mentioned CrimeView replacement project. This is big for our agency. CrimeView has sort of three parts to it. It's a database of computerized criminal histories in Oregon, as well as what we call hot files. And a hot file would be like a warrant or a stolen car record or a protective order. Also, it has a message switch associated with it. So when the inbound message from a user in the field hits that switch, it can send it to the appropriate repository to say, hey, maybe we're not running an Oregon car today, but let's run out and check Florida instead. So it'll route that message to Florida and return a response in under 2 seconds. Also, interestingly, that message switch on every time a person's queried in Oregon, it runs out to the servers in Lyon, France, and checks Interpol to see if they've got international wants too. So it's really a very robust system. CrimeView's the only criminal history repository in Oregon, and like I just mentioned, the message switch connects us to the rest of the U.S. and beyond. So these are very core systems for criminal justice in Oregon. The reason behind the project is because it is an aging system. It's nearly 20 years old, and OSP has a distinct obligation to maintain serviceability of that for all of our partners in the criminal justice arena. And also an ability is necessary to adapt to future requirements by the FBI. They will send us periodically updates to the system that we need to be able to adapt to, and our system right now isn't supported by a vendor. We support it internally. We hope that the outcome of the project will be to achieve nearly 100% uptime and any outages to be planned, and that we can increase functionality to adapt to those FBI requirements and also maximize the usability for our customers out there. OSP is working with LFO, the state CIO's office, and our strategic technology officer in this. The whole project's going to go through the stage gate process, and right now it's still, even though we've been working on it for what seems coming up on 2 years, it's just approaching the project level stage, and it'll approach the first gate, and then we're going to get input from the CIO's office as to whether we can proceed or not. So we're really trying to do our due diligence ahead of time to make sure that that project is constrained in risk and cost and timeline. So I mentioned that there was a message switch associated with the CrimeView replacement project. That's called LEMS, not to be confused with LIMS, which is our laboratory system, but LEMS, Law Enforcement Message Switch. And that, again, is the hub of data exchange. It has 330 million transactions that pass through it per year, and it has a high requirement for uptime, too. So that's within the scope of the project to replace that switch, and that's being considered in the project artifacts. Here's a quick list of the customers who are served by those OSP CJIS systems, and it's virtually everybody that touches the the criminal justice system in Oregon. So, move on. So within the CrimeView array, our technology that we have there is deployed is beyond its end of life, both for the software and the hardware. And the SAIC was the original vendor of that. And SAIC, I don't think even exists anymore, but they no longer support the system. And there is some risk now of catastrophic failure of that system, which we want to obviously avoid by getting ahead of that and replacing the system before that does happen, and really get to a point where we can achieve those industry standards of reliability, usability, and compatibility with other systems. So here's a timeline for our project on the CrimeView replacement project. You can see that today on the near horizon in May is Stage Gate 1 approval. And since this project is kind of a elephant, we're going to try and eat it one bite at a time. And that's one stage gate at a time in this project. So we'll be bringing on professional project management as well as business analysts to assist us with this, and deliver a project, like I mentioned before, within the triple constraint of budget, time, and scope. So here's a, I mentioned the Fujitsu Q704, and I probably should have mentioned that it's got added functionality of being able to be used in the car and in the dock. This has been a quick overview of OSP's IT infrastructure. It's difficult to fit in so much in such a short amount of time, and I hope that we've met the needs of the committee, and we're certainly happy to take questions now if you have any.
Yes.
Thank you. You know, go back to slide 10. Are your computer systems serviced by DAS? I mean, do they go through a DAS server?
So Representative Nathanson, Senator Riley, co-chairs, and Senator Whitsitt, we have systems that are in at DAS ETS. Yes, we do. And then we have systems that are not, depending on which one you're talking about specifically. For instance, our CrimeView database, which I spent a long time talking about, is hosted at our Anderson Readiness Center down there, so our techs can immediately get their hands on it, and it's our sole charge to be responsible for that system. So the answer is yes and no. We have some in both, and if we ever decide to stand up a new system, our first default position is that it goes at ETS.
Okay. Follow up. I just learned from the Department of Transportation a few days ago that their DAS service charge for their IT system is $40 million biennium. I was wondering, what is your charge for your DAS charge for their systems?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and Senator Whitsitt. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but it's proportional to that, I can tell you.
And one follow-up, is that included in the $9.2 million of the that your IT costs?
Yes.
So would that be in the 79% of personal services, or the 10% services and supplies, or?
It's general fund for us, and if you need more information on that, I can be happy to bring that back to you. So if you want to know exactly what our DAS charges are, we can have that and definitely deliver it to the committee.
Actually, I would like to know what all of your service charges are from DAS. I'm on a mission there.
Yes, sir.
You may have noticed they've gone up some.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Riley, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. Next up, we have the Department of Justice. We have Lauren King and Mark Williams. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Williams, and I lead the Administrative Services Division for the Department of Justice. And as soon as we have our presentation up, I'll begin speaking about that. I would like to tell you, starting right off, our first slide talks a little bit about our mission and as well as our values and goals. And I'd like to talk more with you about those, but in the interest of time, I will introduce you to our Chief Information Officer, Lauren King. She can talk a little bit about the technology and the strategy behind all of those individual values and goals.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Lauren King, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Justice. And Mark talked extremely briefly about the DOJ mission and what we are dedicated to. I'm going to move on to a slide that shows the organization, the high-level organization of DOJ. Of course, it is run by the Attorney General Rosenblum and our Deputy Attorney General Fred Boss and our eight divisions. We have several legal divisions, the Child Support Division, and the Administrative Services Division. And you'll see the blue bubble, kind of a call out there. That is our IT governance committee and structure within the Department of Justice. So the DOJ executive leadership team serves as that governance committee for all things IT. Just a slide here to show you the 15-17 modified agency budget overall, so you can see the DOJ budget. I also like to sort of call out that our child support division is really the biggest division within the Department of Justice. We'll talk a little bit more in depth about a big project for the child support program a little bit later on in the slides. The next slide here shows the information services organization structure. The Administrative Services Division Administrator, Mark Williams, myself as the CIO. We do have the Child Support Technology Services as a dotted line relationship to myself due to the fact that the nature of that work that that team does is exclusively dedicated to maintaining and enhancing the child support system that they use to administer the child support program. So it's embedded within the child support division and its program. We also have the IT infrastructure services, application services. We have a dedicated information security officer and a very new addition to the team, a litigation support analyst, and I'll talk a little bit further about these specific services. Just a very brief slide to show the information services budget overall. It is roughly 4% of DOJ's total budget, so it's a relatively small piece, but I think it's pretty effective. Here are the DOJ major technology systems. Of course, we have our child support, case, and financial management system. Again, I'll talk more about that in future slides, but that is really the core system that is used by child support staff and child support program staff who fall outside of DOJ in really administering the child support program. We also have a child support document generation system. It is outside of the case and financial management system. As you might imagine, it's a pretty document-heavy process, administering, establishing child support orders, a lot of legal documents and so forth. So we have a separate system to generate those types of documents. We have the Child Support Employer Services Portal. This is a brand new program or system that we have, which we now offer employers an online portal to manage their business with the child support program. Employers are required to withhold from wages child support payments. They also must respond to and deal with providing information about health care for the children and so forth, and we allow this all to be done electronically online. Previous to implementation of this portal, it was all paper-based, so we've eliminated a very heavily paper-based process and made it online and virtually paperless. We also have the legal matter management systems, several little silos of systems that we have built internally ourselves over the years. These manage case information about all of the legal matters that DOJ handles. We also have an electronic data discovery system, pretty old and antiquated. We're looking at replacing it. The world of electronic data discovery is quite complex, quite technical, quite large. So we are looking at new tools and new expertise to help us continue to mature in the area of electronic discovery within the department. We have our time keeping and billing system. That's for attorneys to track their time and allow us to be able to bill client agencies for their time. We have an enterprise document management system. It maintains all of our documents across the agency. It is basically a paperless way to manage documentation within the department. Obviously, we have an email system, a live email system, an archive, and a spam filtering system. So we've got a lot of technology around email and its security. We have, of course, the internet and the intranet that provide services outwardly facing to DOJ customers, as well as to our internal staff. We have office automation, clearly off Microsoft Office project, those typical office automation products that we all know and love. We have a lot of information security technologies in place, firewalls, encryption, user authentication, and we're continually looking to add more tools, products, and other best practices around information security. And finally, we have a mobile device management system that manages all of our smartphones, our tablets, and that allows us to know what user has what device. We can whitelist applications that are acceptable to be loaded on the devices, and we can also remotely wipe those devices clean should they be lost or stolen. Some of the programs and customers that are served by information services within the DOJ are certainly all of our staff, all of our partners, and of course the citizens of the state. We have several outwardly facing programs and such that the citizens interact with, and those are the systems that we support in information services. We provide technology solutions also to 25 county DA offices that run a child support program. So they log into our child support case management system, and we provide support for that access into that system as well as their ability to work within it. We also serve child support interface partners, and that's where you see this little colored diagram here is just kind of an example of the dozens upon dozens of other agencies and programs that our child support system interfaces with, sharing data and information and so forth. And then, of course, back to serving all of Department of Justice staff across the state, including approximately 50 law clerks that come on every year during the summertime. In information services, we have several areas that provide services. We have IT infrastructure services. Those are your typical servers, network team, customer service, or help desk teams. They manage all of the computing hardware, the networking software, security around the network and those things, as well as our customer service team providing help desk services and desktop end user customer services to ensure that applications and the computing environment is working for our end users. We have our IT application services group. Those are our developers, our programmers. These are the folks who have developed internally developed applications such as our legal case management system. They support those systems. They are always looking for ways to build better programs, looking at commercial off-the-shelf products to see if there's maybe a COTS product out there that can serve a need rather than building an application in-house. We also provide IT project management within the systems development group. I talked a little bit about COTS administration or commercial off-the-shelf software. Once you implement a COTS solution, you have to manage that solution through a vendor relationship, manage the contract with that vendor, and so forth. So we provide those services. And then our web development and support group, supporting the internet and the intranet for the department, and those web applications that are outwardly facing.
Did you have a?
Sure.
I did, thank you. Once again, with the Department of Justice, do you do your computer systems interface with DAS at all? And if so, to what extent?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, we do have our child support case management system at the Enterprise Technology Services. It's housed out there. The database and the application is housed out there. And so we do interface with DAS, Enterprise Technology Services, for that system specifically. And then, of course, DAS also provides telephone communications, state local and wide area network services and so forth. Other systems that I've mentioned, email and several others, we support internally at DOJ.
Okay. Paula, could you get us information on what DAS charges you for the servers and so forth?
co-chairs, members of the committee, absolutely, we will do that.
Be very helpful if we could have this the current biennium, the next biennium projected, and then if they have a projection for 17-19 as well.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Our Child Support Technology Services Group, as I had mentioned earlier, is really dedicated and solely focused on providing services through the child support case management and financial management system. So they keep the system up and running. They do work with DAS, Enterprise Technology Services. They manage the database. They ensure that that system, because it's very critical to the business, that it's up and running and providing the technology and serving the needs for the case management managers and the program. Information security officer, we do have a dedicated permanent FTE for the department, an information security officer, because information security is extremely important to the Department of Justice. Being the state's attorney, we do handle the most sensitive of data, and we are always looking for ways to secure that data better, constantly watching for potential breaches and attacks on our systems and so forth, and having that dedicated person who is experienced and knowledgeable and keeps up on the latest technologies and trends and best practices is very key to information security, and we're very, very proud of our maturity in this area. We also have a litigation support analyst, pretty new to our group, and it is again
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said you're always watching for possible breaches. Mm-hmm. Of course, individuals should be vigilant, watching when something is, seems to be going awry. But what do you have automated that's watching or monitoring network activity or password tries or whatever it is? Do you also have automated things running in the background?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes, we do have automated tools in place that look for attacks on our systems. For example, IP addresses that we know are coming from foreign countries, China, for example. We look for those kinds of IP addresses trying to come in and get to our system.
But you probably don't want to tell us exactly what those are.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
So we do have, there's a lot of different tools that can be implemented. We have implemented many of those types of tools. I'd like to go back for a brief moment and talk a little bit about people. Social engineering is probably one of the toughest types of cyber attacks to control, because people want to be nice and helpful within an organization. Someone calls you up and says, I'm Joe from the help desk. Well, you know there is a Joe that works on your help desk, and he's just trying to reset your password. So we really look to educate our users continuously, and we send them newsletters and tips and so forth to really watch for these kinds of things. We believe it is perfectly acceptable and expected that our staff actually not answer those types of questions and call back the help desk or the person that they know works on our help desk and say, did you just call me and ask me this, because I'm trying to prevent some sort of social engineering and so forth. So we are very keen on that. Back to the litigation support analyst, just very briefly, we have hired someone who has been in the litigation support and particularly in the electronic data discovery field for many years, because once again, it is a very large, highly technical area of litigation and supporting that litigation, getting documentation or electronic files from either opposing counsel or collecting, doing that data collection within the department or with our client agencies, and really processing that data and making sure that it is the appropriate information relevant to a case and so forth. So there's just a lot of areas within that industry that we felt we needed a little more expertise from the technology perspective to help us navigate those waters and, again, become more mature in electronic data discovery.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Ms. King, are you able to adequately interface with eCourt?
co-chairs, members of the committee, we are, and in fact, we are have implemented electronic filing for our child support orders, with, and that's part of the e-court program.
Mm-hmm. On your follow-up, on your also on your investigative divisions and so forth, it's working well then throughout your Department of Justice with your interface with e-court.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, as far as I am aware of, we are certainly interfacing with e-court and following their recent implementation of e-filing within the courts that are on the e-court system. I know that there are several other courts that haven't enrolled into it yet, so we still have to do manual filings, but absolutely with the e-filing process, we definitely are interfacing and doing that electronic filing for the child support and other areas within
Thank
DOJ.
You.
Yeah. So we've got the next couple of slides to talk a little bit about our projects and accomplishments this current biennium, and at the top of the list, but certainly not in any particular order necessarily, but I like to put information security at the top. We continue to look for ways to improve our information security posture through tools, through education, through automation, and that constant watchful eye. A couple of examples are we implemented the multi-factor user authentication agency-wide. So anyone who is logging on to our system must authenticate with a username, a 14-character passphrase, and a third authentication method. We've chosen what they call a grid card method. Looks kind of like a bingo card, and you have to enter some characters. But you must have those three pieces in order to get inside in the front door of DOJ. And we've implemented that agency-wide, and our DA partners as well use that authentication method. We've also implemented hard drive and laptop and portable drive encryption. So all of our drives are encrypted agency-wide. And we've implemented some network auditing software and encrypted file sharing systems. And what those are is, if you've ever heard of Dropbox, that's where anybody can put a file somewhere and invite somebody else to come and get it. We've implemented an encrypted secure solution called Active Echo that allows us to share files outside of DOJ with our partners or whomever in an encrypted fashion, so it's very secure.
Yes, sir.
Two things. Give me an example of a partner with whom you would share information by putting it in this encrypted Dropbox.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Nathanson, we have a lot of partners. LFO is a partner. We use an FTP or a secure file transfer protocol for their files. Several of our agency partners like DHS or DMV, many other state agencies. I also know that our criminal justice division shares with other law enforcement agencies, sheriff's offices, and so forth. They use this Active Echo encrypted solution to put files that they need to share with that community out on this site.
Okay, so but we're talking about government partners,
generally
whether it's
it is.
State or local.
Generally, it is co-chairs, members of the committee. Generally, it is partners, government partners, but we do have some, for example, public records requests. We are now looking at publishing those out to this Active Echo site to share as a public records request or with client agencies, and we've even examined it for possible sharing of documents with opposing counsel in some cases. So that would not necessarily be a government agency.
Mm-hmm. Can I follow
Absolutely.
This line
Great.
For a minute? So I'm picturing you have something that's sensitive information, eyes only, but someone else needs to see it. What assurances do we, the state, have that whoever's picking it up, that their system is adequately protected, and this thing that we've just let them have access to, maybe their system is not as well protected as ours?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Nathanson, that is a risk in anything when you are delivering a document that contains sensitive information. While it's encrypted in transit and at rest in this location with this software, this Active Echo, and we we ensure that we have to invite the person we're sending it to and give them access into that site to pick up the documents. But once they download those documents from that site, it's really out of our hands, and that is a risk that if that other agency or the partner that we are delivering those documents to places it in their system somewhere that's not secure, that is a risk.
Do we have some sort of standard contract or intergovernmental agreement that explains our expectations for how that document should be secured?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we do not at this time that I'm aware of.
Oh.
Follow up?
Yeah. Seems like someone ought to talk about that as an appropriate policy. The second question, and I really, it's just occurred to me, I should have been asking every agency, do you have a policy on allowing people to take laptops off premises, like to the home or the coffee shop? Or
co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Nathanson, excuse me, we absolutely have a policy around all of our devices and accessing the network and what devices they use. In fact, with the security requirements that we are under, because we have access to federal tax information as well as criminal justice information systems data and a lot of other sensitive data, we have very strict policies around the use of laptops and tablets and even home computers. In fact, our remote access agreement requires our staff to indicate that they are not accessing FTI or sensitive information using a home computer, because it's required by those regulatory bodies that the equipment be owned by the department. And we encrypt those devices, so the devices that we own are encrypted.
And I hope that includes smartphones, too.
Absolutely.
Anything that can have access to the data. Thank you.
And if I may follow up on that just a little bit, do you also have the ability to erase those remotely?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes, we do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. So we'll continue with our list. I'll try to get this through pretty quickly. I wanted to mention the next bullet item, which is our child support system project. We completed the initiation phase of that project. It is falling, albeit slightly loosely, within the stage gate process through the state CIO's office, because we had started the project long before that stage gate process had been fully vetted and implemented, but now we're fitting it in within that process. So we finished the initiation phase and completed a lot of the pre-work that happens in that initiation phase for that project. We've also, we developed the employer services portal that I mentioned earlier for our child support program. We've implemented central voice over IP infrastructure, which is a telecommunications infrastructure to back up our criminal justice division's system, because they didn't have a backup system. And we're looking to roll out VoIP video conferencing agency-wide. We are hosting the payroll consolidation pilot project, or proof of concept project. This is where three agencies have come together to provide a shared service, the payroll services. We are partnering with Department of Revenue, DCBS, and then Department of Justice, and we are hosting that environment. So the payroll will be served to those three agencies through this central shared services group. We entered into a Microsoft Enterprise agreement, finally, which can save money over time for entering into those services. Again, we hired the litigation support expert to help us mature in the area of specifically in electronic data discovery. We've implemented several different alternative payment methods for folks to be able to pay their child support more conveniently through kiosks. An online payment portal for them to make their child support payments. So we're looking for ways to really enable those who are obligated to pay child support to make it easier for them. We've upgraded our child support calculator that is used by our program partners and the public. We've upgraded our charities program, paving the way to push that to a more automated system online, redesigning some business processes. We've implemented new software work order request system, where users can request changes to our systems or report bugs and so forth. It was in an old Access database. Now we've implemented a system where the requester can actually follow where those requests are and whether they're being worked on, approved, and so forth. We upgraded all of our desktops agency-wide from the old Windows XP operating system to Windows 7, eliminating that security risk with Windows XP. And we've upgraded several operating systems and databases and COTS products to the latest versions and so forth, trying to keep up with all of the latest versions of those softwares. For the 15-17 biennium, we have several projects and a few requests. The first being our child support system project, Policy Option Package 201. I will talk a little bit further in later on in the slide deck, but that's our big project. That's the largest IT project that the department has ever undergone, and it's very important to us, very business critical project, and I'll give you more details on the status and the progress and so forth here in a couple of slides. We also have an electronic records and legal case management policy package. Our legal case management systems, as I described earlier, are very antiquated, using old technology, and the records management system that houses all of those legal case file documents is needing to be replaced and so forth, so we're looking at an effort there. We are going to upgrade the department's website. It hasn't been upgraded in over a decade, and it's time for newer technologies and a bit of a facelift there. We are going to upgrade our child support document generation system. It's based on WordPerfect, believe it or not. So we're going to get out of the golden age and come up to the new age. We're looking at deploying email archive in the Microsoft Government Cloud. That'll really help our on-premise storage and allow our users to actually have access to email archives. So they'll be stored offline, saving that storage, but users will still be able to access those archived emails. We are planning to deploy Identity Services Engine and Network Access Control. Those are, again, some security pieces. The Identity Services Engine really is a way of identifying what devices are trying to connect to our network. And if it's not a DOJ device or an approved device, it won't be able to connect. The Network Access Control looks at that device trying to connect and says, do you have antivirus software? Is your operating system patched? Is it up to the appropriate levels and standards that DOJ has? If it's not, it will not let you connect. We are going to be deploying data loss prevention for our mobile drives and so forth. That really looks at when you plug in a USB or a CD and you want to download a document or some file that has a social security number in it or credit card number or so forth, it will log it or it will take it all the way to the step of not allowing it to be downloaded on that device. It's business driven, so whatever business decision we make, we will implement, but it's a software that actually allows that level of security on that device. And then we're looking at expanding video monitoring sensitive areas within the department, you know, certainly server rooms and things where there is high-dollar equipment and secure areas, but also in some of our child support offices and other sensitive areas where there is sensitive information and other things. So I'm going to move on, if I can, to the major IT projects. And here's where I'm going to talk a little more about.
Senator Whitsitt?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Policy Package 201 and 211, do you have, or 111, do you have dollar values on those?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Riley, members of the committee, I do not have those numbers with me today, but I certainly can get those to you. At this point, the child support system project, the overall project estimate is $109
million. Okay. And follow up?
Yes.
The will that system work independently, or will it use the DAS servers?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the child support system, at this particular point, our analysis has been to assume that the ETS will host the system. However, we are doing our diligence in looking at other hosting options due to cost of hosting, security, information security issues, and those sorts of things to do the analysis and make an informed and logical and best for the program decision.
And one follow-up. I would be interested to know what the estimated ongoing biennial cost of being hosted by DAS would be.
Absolutely, we can provide
that.
Mm-hmm. So as I may have mentioned earlier, if I hadn't, the child support program, the current system, is an old antiquated system based on COBOL programming language. I don't know if you've all heard of that, but it's something very old. It's very hard to find programmers that actually utilize that language anymore. It's an old mainframe-based system, so it really is in dire need of an upgrade.
I think we have two COBOL programmers on the panel.
And I think we have the rest of them currently supporting the system at DOJ. So.
I think there's a number of them at DMV.
Yeah. Certainly this project is we are partnering with the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement on this project, as they provide two-thirds of the funding for the child support program. So we are working with them, and the relationship is very good with them on a multi-year project that we are undertaking here. The new system will also allow the program to stay in compliance with federal requirements and allow us to compete for federal incentive dollars and keep up with the increasing caseload demands that we see. We conducted a feasibility study, which was the first step in this project a few years ago, November of 11 through October of 12 is the time frame we completed the feasibility study. And during that time, or on sort of on the coattails of that, we did a business process reengineering project, because the last thing we want to do is design and implement a child support system that is really just designed after old business practices. So we really looked at business processes and re-engineering those and bringing those up to a more streamlined process and what would really meet the needs of today. And then we got implementation approval from the 2013 legislature to proceed into the next phase of the project. The current status of the project is we are officially right now in the planning phase of the project. We have four procurements involved in this project. The first procurement is completed. It was for a project management contractor. We recognized early on that DOJ did not have the expertise to manage a project of this size, so we hired a project management contractor. They were onboarded in October of last year. We will have a systems integrator. The big contract in this project is a systems integrator. We are bringing systems from other states into Oregon and integrating them, so we're not totally reinventing the wheel. But once again, DOJ staff do not have that expertise, so we're hiring an integrator who has a great deal of experience in integrating child support systems and implementing those in other states. We also have a quality assurance contractor that we are working to bring on. We are in contract negotiations with them, or actually we just recently completed them. We're hoping to bring them on early May. We're very optimistic that we may be able to get them here by May 1st, but certainly early May to come on and do risk assessment and that early QA on the project. And then finally, an independent verification and validation contractor. This is really the federal eyes and ears on the project. It's required by the feds to have a separate IVNV contract, separate from the QA contractor, and they come on site every 6 months for a 10-day period and just do an assessment and verify the quality and all of the things going on in the project. We're also developing those foundational documents, project charter. In fact, we're almost complete with the initial development of those. Project charter, business case, project plans, communication plans, all of those foundational planning documents that will really be used as project controls going forward with the project. That will also be an early deliverable of our quality assurance contractors to review those plans for their quality and so forth. So that will be coming very, very soon, the review of those. The oversight of this project clearly is the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, certainly the LFO, the state CIO's office, and I mentioned earlier we're fitting into that stage gate process, and our quality assurance contractor certainly is going to be part of that, looking at the quality and so forth. And then we have a project steering committee. This is the project steering committee for this project. It is a multi-agency steering committee with members from DHS, Oregon Judicial Department, DMV. So we have a nice blend of agencies who have had large IT projects where they're further along than we are, and we can learn those lessons from them. And also with the DMV specifically, they're not quite as far along in their projects, so they're lending some of what they've done in the past and some of those lessons learned, but they're also learning from us as well as we go through this process.
Thank you. Ms. King, you started this project in 2011. We're now obviously getting geared up. Do you have a date when you intend to have it finished and online?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, 2019 is implementation. More detail?
8 years is long enough.
Yeah.
8 years is long enough.
Yeah.
Detail? 8 years is...